I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to explore a topic that is rarely, if ever, discussed in the United States, and that is the exploration into the life and work of Dr. Wilhelm Reich and government censorship of scientific innovation and theories. We're going to be joined by two specialists on the topic. The first will be speaking with us from Silver Springs, Maryland, is Professor James Strict. Professor Strict teaches in the Department of Earth Environmental Studies at Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where he is also the chair of the program in science and technology. He was trained in microbiology and is specialized in the history of science, the history of biological ideas and experimentation into life. He holds multiple degrees, including several master's degrees, one from Princeton University in history and another in environmental science from SUNY, and a doctorate in history from Princeton University. He has published volumes about Darwin, astrobiology, and NASA, and the debate about the origins of life, and an excellent volume about Wilhelm Reich called Wilhelm Reich Biologist, published by Harvard Press. He is an advisor to the journal History of Science Society, where he has also published numerous professional articles. He is joined from Glastonbury, Connecticut, by Kevin Hinchey. Kevin is a film director, professor of cinema photography, and a director of the Wilhelm Reich Infant Trust that manages the Wilhelm Reich Archives at Harvard University's Countway Library of Medicine. He also operates the Wilhelm Reich Museum in Maine. And Kevin has a master's from New York University's Graduate Film School and has worked as a screenwriter in Los Angeles, New York City, and currently teaches filmmaking and course about Reich in Connecticut, Massachusetts. His lecture series, The True Story of Government-Ordered Book Burning in America, about the destruction of tons of Reich's works, is a warning of scientific totalitarianism. Kevin is currently editing a full-feature documentary about the life and thought and research of Wilhelm Reich, the Wilhelm Reich documentary film project, which will be discussed later in the interview. Nice to have you both with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
We're going to start with you on this, James. We're going to be exploring the life and work and theories and legacy of one of what I personally consider the 20th century's most important and yet controversial psychoanalysts, scientists, biologists, and social critics. And one reason for selecting this subject is Reich's legacy represents a trend in American medical politics that continues today. That is censorship and silencing of people who propose theories or create inventions that challenge the status quo. Now, this was certainly true of Reich, whose history today remains riddled with rumors and false claims and ridicule for his being a pseudoscientist, even a charlatan. And yet Reich is in that lineage of brilliant thinkers and innovators and scientific visionaries who questioned the mechanistic view of science and who also had their work censored and destroyed or stolen by the U.S. government in order to avoid it being made available to the public. We might think of Nikola Tesla, Royal Rife. In our current times, it would be Stanislaw Brzezinski, as well as the late Nicholas Gonzalez and Dr. Emmanuel Vesey on their research into alternative cancer treatments. Recently, the Nobel Prize winner for the discovery of the HIV virus, Luc Montagnier, has had his research funding pulled by the French government because of his research in the energetic properties of water that provides scientific evidence for the effectiveness of homeopathy, in spite of the fact that there are more than 69 separate peer-reviewed journal articles that show homeopathy works. In fact, one of those articles was done by a group in Scotland who were doing it to debunk homeopathy. They had no belief in it, and still they came to the conclusion that it works. So the uniqueness of Reich was not only his having been an early disciple of Freud's psychoanalyst, but also as a radical thinker about the causes and treatment of cancer, the role of sexuality in the psychological life of people and sexual liberation, even the manipulation of weather and his harsh psychological critiques about the rise of fascism. So I'd like to begin with you summarizing some of Reich's early life and training and his having been targeted by the Nazis up until his arrival in the United States. And then we'll look more deeply at the details of his work. The forum is yours.
So Reich was born in the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the last days of the empire, and was old enough to enlist in World War I and fought as a lieutenant in the Austrian army in World War I. By the end of the war, he took advantage of a program the government offered to get a medical degree and a bachelor's degree in 4 years total of really intensive study at the University of Vienna. And while he was a medical student in Vienna, he met Freud and began to train as a psychoanalyst. He was deeply interested in sexuality as a source of, you know, fundamental human motivation, but also, he thought, as a basic biological process, not just something that was about, you know, emotions that were in one's head or something like that. He was inspired by Freud's libido theory. Freud, in his early work, believed that there was he had two hypotheses, either some kind of chemical substance or an energy of some kind that would obey conservation of energy laws that was responsible for emotional ups and downs, for things like sexual excitation and sexual satisfaction. And Reich took this idea very seriously and thought that one of the most important things that could bring a more scientific future for psychoanalysis would be if somebody could eventually go into a physiology laboratory and demonstrate that libido was a real, measurable something that one could study quantitatively in a laboratory, which eventually, by 1934, he began to try to do. Reich, as a young psychoanalyst, was very talented, especially in therapeutic technique. He was somebody who, by a very young age, 26 or 27, had already risen to the leadership of Freud's technical seminar in Vienna, and was widely recognized even by rivals in the psychoanalytic movement who were jealous of him as somebody who was extremely gifted as a clinician and in training young analysts in new therapeutic techniques and thinking outside the box about breaking through in therapy in ways that traditional psychoanalysts just never thought of. Reich, for example, was one of the first to break the psychoanalytic tradition of sitting with one's back to the patient and never looking at the patient, trying to remain scientifically aloof, as it were. And he found that the more he observed the patient's physical bodily expressions, facial expressions, that these often told him a lot more about the patient's state of being and even emotional state of being than what the patient was saying about their emotions. It's this line of thinking that eventually led Reich to become what some people today would call the father of body therapies. But as I said, this wasn't in his mind only of interest from a clinical or therapeutic point of view. He thought more basically as a scientific researcher that if one understood libido in a physiology laboratory, one would be in a much better position to deal with neuroses, to prevent neuroses by understanding what were the root causes of people having their libido dammed up. And so, for instance, in sex, being incapable of experiencing complete gratification. He found in his therapy with patients that complete sexual gratification usually led to dramatic improvement in their neurotic symptoms. And this led him to formulate a concept of orgastic potency, that if a patient were capable of fully giving in to the discharge of libido, as he called it at that time, that was the key to getting better from neurotic symptoms. and that it was the stasis of dammed up libido because of emotional inhibitions or physical inhibitions, muscular tensions, that was the underlying cause of neurosis. The undischarged libido was the energy that fueled the neurotic symptoms Reich felt. And if one understands this concept of orgastic potency, you can see in many ways the rest of Reich's research legacy play out based on that concept, starting with the move into the laboratory to study libido physiologically. There was a series of serendipitous developments in Reich's laboratory work in the mid-1930s. He did measure that bioelectrical charge at the surface of the skin increased dramatically in pleasure responses, decreased dramatically in anxiety responses, and his theoretical understanding of this was that pleasure consisted of the movement of energy from within the core of the organism out to the periphery, and that anxiety consisted of the movement of that same energy. Bioelectricity was what he was measuring in the experiments, from the periphery into the center of the organism, where it would cause things like cardiac anxiety. Reich began to wonder whether or not this basic movement of bioelectric energy might be common to all organisms, not just the human subjects who volunteered for these experiments on emotions and sexual feelings. And he began to look at microorganisms to try to figure out if even the most primitive organisms might demonstrate a similar movement of bioelectric charge from the core to the periphery and back again under states that would correspond in some fundamental sense to the different emotional states of a larger, more complex organism. And it's those investigations that eventually led him serendipitously to what he began to think were origin of life experiments, where it appeared to him that microorganisms were actually being created in his laboratory out of non-living starting materials. He called these bions, these tiny microorganisms that had many, many characteristics of living things, like bioelectrical charge at the surface. They could be cultured through multiple generations in sterile culture media. And he began to believe that he had stumbled on something more fundamental even than libido, some kind of an energy that might be the energy of living organisms per se. It's worth stating that in the 19-teens and early 1920s, a handful of biologists imagined that eventually one might resolve the question of the difference between living and non-living matter by hypothesizing the existence of a specific life energy that was present in living matter and absent or converted into something else like heat or light or other forms of energy in non-living matter. And Reich had learned about this during his university education and began to suspect that he might be on to the discovery of an energy of that kind in these cultures of microorganisms that he called bions. The book that you described that I published last year called Wilhelm Reich, Biologist, is about these microbiological experiments, about how Reich starts from investigating the physiology of libido and ends up serendipitously in what appeared to be origin of life experiments. And another reason why I felt it was important to look at these experiments was because they're also the source of Reich's theory of the origin of cancer. As you mentioned, Reich had a very unorthodox theory of the nature of cancer. It was related to his overall understanding of psychosomatic processes in general. But in the bion experiments, he observed that occasionally the microbes that he was studying, these bions as he called them, would form from the disintegration of dead, decaying material, either from plants or animals. And that he began to imagine that a similar process might take place in the tissues of a patient with some serious debilitating disease, where the tissues could be deprived of energy, deprived of oxygen, and dying in a similar way to dead grass or moss soaking in water under his microscope. And when he observed live tissue from cancer patients, he did indeed see processes very similar to the ones that he saw microscopically when he studied infusions of, let's say, disintegrating dead plant material. So he began to think that the bions that formed from the disintegration of oxygen-deprived or energy-starved tissue and then later clumped together into protozoa-like forms, which Reich found soon were indistinguishable from the mobile cancer cells in the live tissue that he looked at from cancer patients, that this was the process that originated cancer. And it set him to work trying to understand what were the processes that caused the energy deprivation and the oxygen starvation in those tissues, and that therefore set them in the process of disintegrating into bions, and the bions eventually reforming into cancer cells. So anybody really who wants to form an opinion of Reich's theory of cancer or of Reich's discovery of what he called orgon energy, this energy that he hypothesized was the specific biological energy, really should start with these bion experiments that Reich conducted in Oslo, Norway, where he was in exile from the Nazis in the late 1930s. His falling out with the psychoanalytic community is largely based on the fact that he became more and more interested in Marxism and leftist political thought, as he thought that neuroses were produced more by social conditions than anything else, and that psychoanalysts were doing nothing more than putting a Band-Aid on a small number of people who they could treat in their clinics and ignoring the social causes of neurosis. He sought in the workers' movements and left-wing political parties to try to really move for mass reforms on a social basis. For example, the repeal of laws against abortion, which were pretty much ubiquitous even in Weimar and other progressive regimes in the 1920s. At the same time that the psychoanalysts were criticizing him for becoming too political on the left, he was being criticized by the rising Nazi movement because his understanding of mass psychology, especially as encapsulated in his 1933 book, The Mass Psychology of Fascism, which came out shortly after Hitler's seizure of power, was a really incisive analysis of how the Nazi movement manipulated the helplessness of the public in order to gain political power. And the Nazis were, of course, not at all interested in having such a book out there getting people to think about how it is that they were being manipulated. So many of Reich's publications, including The Mass Psychology of Fascism, were being burned by the Nazis, and he had to flee from Germany and work in exile after the Nazi seizure of power in 1933.
Okay, I appreciate that overview. Thank you. Let's go over to Kevin. Kevin, as a follow-up to that, could you set the stage for the idea that we're learning more about Reich today that is relevant to today? Because some people would say, why are you even discussing the rationale of putting forth information on a man who's been dead for a long time, whose work is virtually forgotten by history, and yet there is a very legitimate reason why you would take the time and energy to do a documentary on him to show the people today why Reich is relevant today?
Yeah, I think you put that very well, Gary. Reich's, as Professor Strick has articulated, Reich's life and work intersects with so many different intellectual subjects and political subjects and things like that. And I think you're correct that Reich is largely dismissed today. He certainly has a following among certain circles, but you can't really say that Reich has a tremendous influence because he has been so maligned. He has been so dismissed. There are so many falsehoods, which essentially started during his lifetime and persist to this day, so many falsehoods about his life and work. And the fact that an agency of the United States government, specifically the Food and Drug Administration, was responsible for the banning and burning of Reich's books in 1956 on two occasions, several tons of materials, and again in 1960, 3 years after Reich's death. So we're talking about a significant amount of publications, all of which have been reprinted, by the way. But the stigma of books being banned and burned in the United States has really haunted Reich and has really contributed to much of his legacy being dismissed. But as Professor Strick articulated, there are many aspects of his psychoanalytic work, the fact that he really can be considered the father of mind-body psychology, the research that he did into the origins of the cancer cell, and the experimental treatment of patients with cancer and other diseases, and his weather research. There is a significant psychoanalytic, medical, and scientific legacy, which Reich articulates very well in his publications. And there are, in fact, now available. There are 23 book titles by Reich. There's and all of his research journals that were banned and burned are available in reprints. And so, as we point out in some of the interviews in the film, what's in these books? What is it that we can learn? What is it that has been lost by the fact that many of these books were banned and burned by the Food and Drug Administration of the United States because of specific content in those books? And so, in terms of the film, the Wilhelm Reich Documentary Film Project, and I researched this for many years, what I've done is I've just essentially connected the dots from Reich's publications, from his unpublished materials, such as laboratory notebooks, personal diaries, and journals. I've connected the dots and am assembling a factually accurate documentary film about Reich. There have been films about Reich. There have been museum exhibits about Reich. There are many books and articles about Reich, and the distortions persist because most of the people responsible for these projects have not sufficiently researched the primary materials, Reich's publications, his unpublished archives, the government files of four different government agencies in this country, which were investigating Reich, the State Department, the FBI, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and finally the FDA. And so this film is essentially really connecting the dots and trying to shine a light on much of Reich's legacy, and not in any sort of polemical or strong-arm way. People ask me, well, what do you hope to accomplish with this film? And to answer that, I would say a factually accurate presentation in a 90, 100, 110-minute film where anyone watching this who knows little or nothing about Reich will get the facts. And after they see the film, what their response is, what they decide to do with this, whether they're interested in any of this, that's up to them. That's beyond my purview. But I think Reich has such a rich legacy, and he has been maligned so much to this day, that I think it's about time that there is at least one factually accurate documentary about Reich, and so that people will be introduced to it in an intellectually honest way and can simply make up their minds about what Reich has to contribute to psychoanalysis and psychiatry, to biology, to cancer research, and as you mentioned, even to some of his later weather research.
Okay. I might add something there. When I initially got interested in Reich's Bion experiments and decided that, you know, it would be worth the time to do the research for a book-length project on this, one of the most important reasons that I got interested in it was because the dominant narratives about Reich are that, you know, this is a classic textbook case of pseudoscience. And as a historian of science, I thought there was a really unique opportunity here. Historians of science have really become interested in the last 20, 30 years in closely examining laboratory notebooks of scientists to see what we can glean from them. And it seemed to me like if Reich's laboratory notebooks were preserved, which it turned out when his archives opened to scholars, they had been, then one could test this hypothesis of whether or not Reich's laboratory science was actually nothing more than pseudoscience. Because if what was in those notebooks in day-by-day laboratory practice corresponded to what was in Reich's published writings about his experimental work, that would be a pretty strong indication that this was not pseudoscience, that whatever it was, and if people wanted to disagree about the meaning of Reich's observations, the conversation could productively move forward because we could no longer waste our time talking about whether it was pseudoscience. We could at least accept that Reich did see what he says he saw, that he did measure what he says he measured, and now we could spend our time more productively trying to discuss what it means. Do we think that Reich was correct in his interpretation of orgone energy as an explanation for the radiation phenomena that he measured in bion cultures? Do we think that his microscopic observations between these disintegrating plant tissue cultures and the disintegrating tissue in cancer patients really are parallel? And if so, what kind of medical insights could we glean from this that might actually be useful in saving patients from cancer or in preventing cancer? So it seemed to me like a really interesting case precisely because it's so ubiquitously considered pseudoscience. And as I said, I come to the conclusion in my book after really closely examining his laboratory notebooks that whatever this is, it's not pseudoscience. In many ways, Reich in light microscopy was at the cutting edge of research in the late 1930s, especially in time-lapse filming through the microscope of processes that took a long time to develop.
That's a significant point that Professor Trick makes. He is the first person to have published anything about Reich who actually studied Reich's laboratory notebooks. So when you see a lot of these narratives about Reich and these distortions and falsehoods about Reich, a lot of this is pure opinion or perhaps falsehoods that originated many years ago simply being regurgitated, and they're all over. But one of the things that I always appreciated about Professor Strick's work, he went into the archives, Reich's archives, which are kept at the Conway Library of Medicine up at Harvard, and he actually studied Reich's original laboratory notebooks from the 1930s and early 40s as really as the basis for his book Wilhelm Reich Biologist, which is the reason when I embarked on my research for the Wilhelm Reich documentary film project, and then I later got into production, I wanted Professor Strick as one of the consultants on this project because he had gone to the laboratory notebooks. I had also, but not to the extent that Professor Strick did, because he's a science historian and I'm not. So that's a very significant point, that he went back to the original primary materials.
Although it's worth also saying that many of the falsehoods that widely circulate about Reich, you wouldn't have to go to archival materials to recognize that they're wrong. Yes, the common falsehood that Reich claimed to be able to cure cancer in his research, all you have to do is read Reich's published book on the subject of his cancer research called The Cancer Biopathy. And he tells you that, you know, every single one of the late stage hopeless cancer patients who came to him for an experimental therapy, every single one of the patients died. He's very clear about that. And how anybody who actually reads Ryack's work and sees this clear-cut account that every one of the experimental patients died could walk around convinced that Ryack claimed he could cure cancer. I mean, it's quite clear that the vast majority of the rumors about Ryack are based on secondhand information and people who don't even take the trouble to read Ryack's own published work, which is widely and easily available.
Yeah, great point.
Okay,
yeah.
Now I want to go back to you, Jim, because one of Ryack's better-known theories is that of a kind of universal bioenergy that you discussed briefly at the beginning called orgon, which he associated with the energy behind a sexual orgasm, which you explained. And in many respects, this was a predecessor to what would later be referred to as mind-body medicine or psychosomatic psychology. And I find it rather interesting that what Ryack was proposing might also be considered a kind of secular spirituality when Ryack speaks of sexual release as an emotional release that annihilates the ego or our perceptions of a false self. And this might be something that followers of Eastern religions will find parallels with. Many Eastern teachers have tried to explain higher spiritual self and states of psychological integration as being analogous to a deeper phenomena happening during orgasm. Yet Ryack's view on sexuality were also extremely controversial to the religious morality of the times. Therefore, explain Ryack's theory of orgon and bions, this universal radiation that, as if were that infused such things as bacteria, blood cells, the plants, chlorophyll, and even cancer cells, and how much of it would be relevant today given the advances and increases in knowledge that have been made in biological and sexological research?
Well, that's actually the question that I wanted to leave my readers with in the book, Wilhelm Ryack, Biologist. You know, when I go through Ryack's experiments on the bions and what the evidence is on which he bases his conclusion that he's discovered in these bions a new previously unknown form of energy, and that it is the specific biological energy, which he later calls orgon, when he also is led by what he observes under the microscope to his theory of how cancer cells develop. And I demonstrate in the book that the rejection of his work by the scientific community in the late 1930s was not based on either familiarity with the research itself. None of his opponents ever tried to replicate the experiments. The most you could say is that one of them once visited his lab for 1 hour to watch a demonstration. The only scientist who seriously tried to replicate the experiments, especially Professor Roger Dutail at the University of Nice in France, did successfully get the same results as Ryack in at least 75 or 80% of the experiments that they tried to replicate. But they were almost immediately labeled by other scientists as Ryackians, who couldn't possibly be finding that these things were real because they couldn't possibly be true. And I tried to inquire to find out why the scientists were absolutely adamantly convinced that Ryack was wrong, when it was clear that the usual scientific practice of replicating the experiments had not taken place. Many of them were deeply offended by his sexual theories. Many of them were quite critical and skeptical of his Marxism and his attempt to use dialectical materialist philosophy in experimental design and in interpreting his biological experiments. He crossed so many disciplinary boundaries that a lot of scientists were very uncomfortable with somebody who was, even if he was trained as a doctor, that he would go from being a specialist in psychoanalysis to thinking that he could also become a specialist in physiology and thinking that he could also then become a specialist in microbiology and then in cancer research. For many scientists, the vast majority, that was just too much. That's not their culture. Their culture increasingly has become that you really can only be considered reliable in one area of specialization. And they can only view somebody who tries to be too interdisciplinary as a sign of arrogance in their view. But the more I dug into this, I also found that there was intense competition for a limited pool of funding. At the height of the Great Depression in the late 1930s, practically the only source of large-scale funding for laboratory research in the life sciences was the Rockefeller Foundation. And Reich was applying for Rockefeller Foundation funding for his Bion experiments. But the Rockefeller Foundation had a rather informal way of peer-reviewing grant applications. They went around to other people who had previously gotten grants from them and asked them their opinion of this new person's work and the proposal that they submitted. And Reich's, I guess you'd say his rivals in science in Oslo, who were also getting funding from the Rockefeller Foundation, clearly had a conflict of interest at stake when the Rockefeller Foundation officer came to them and said, "This guy's asking for a lot of money too. What do you think about his research?" I mean, it was a zero-sum game in their mind. And I think it's at least highly suggestive that another important motivation for their dismissal of Reich's work is that he was not only not a member of their old boy network, but he would be cutting into the pie that they were already splitting amongst themselves in a way that they were not happy about. So I come to the conclusion that if Reich's science was not dismissed at the time based on any kind of scientific fair hearing, then I'm urging basically the scientific community who reads my book, it may well be worth going back and trying to replicate some of these experiments and trying to assess whether or not Reich really was onto something important about cancer that modern cancer research overlooks.
James, I want to interject here because I'd like both of you to address the following issue. I was a research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology for over 33 years, and I did two types of research. One was nutritional research and anti-aging, and the other was Psi research. One was tolerated, but the other was never discussed. Just the lab director knew I was doing it. And there would be times in the evening when people would come to visit to see the experiments being done. And a friend of mine was Linus Pauling, the only American to ever win two unshared Nobel Prizes. Also, there was a man who was a great physician and psychiatrist, Abram Hoffer, clearly one of the brightest men in fact, it was Abram Hoffer and Linus Pauling together who created orthomolecular psychiatry. They together. And then there was Dr. Emanuele Rivisi, and he is, in my opinion, the most brilliant scientist I've ever met in my life. He was in the Pasteur of our time. Well, there the three of them were one evening, and they were discussing topics, and I asked them, of all the people who have come before you or were at some point in your life or influenced you, and it was interesting because Pauling mentioned Wilhelm Reich.
Wow.
And that rather surprised me because I was not read up very much on Reich at the time. I had done a five-part series on Reich, but that would be later. And each of those three gentlemen shared something in common. They were well-published, they were accepted for their brilliance, but Pauling was different in that he was adamant, and because he was adamant and political, they went after him. And they cut off all of his funding, they had the Quackbusters and others try to destroy his reputation, and yet, when he was talking about vitamin C helping prevent cancer and helping in the treatment, it would later show that he was correct. And yet at the time, he would talk about how tough it was, and he said to me, he said, "Gary, I published, I believe he said, over 465 articles, and yet at this point in his life, he'd be lucky to get any article published because of how much damage they'd done to his reputation." Now, that's because he won the Nobel Prize not for chemistry at that time, but for peace, and he was demonstrating he was not afraid to stand up for his views. So here's the issue. Right now, throughout the independent media, we're witnessing warnings of the U.S. turning into a postmodern fascist state. The late, great Princeton Emeritus Professor of Political Science and a thought leader behind the free speech movement was Professor Sheldon Wolin, who warned on this program. And in his final publication called Democracy, Inc., that the U.S. was entering into what he called inverted totalitarianism. It is not a dictatorship in the classical definition. Rather, it is a manufactured democracy that is little more than a spectacle, pageantry, and a social ritual to enable people to believe the U.S. is a democratic nation and their direct participants in the electoral process. And we also have two presidential candidates, Trump and Hillary Clinton, who, at least from the criticism of many wonderful scholars and journalists on the progressive left, represent dark figures with fascistic leanings. If Reich had remained in Nazi Germany, he would have been terminated for his vocal disdain towards Hitler and the Nazis.
Yes.
And later he even published the book, The Mass Psychology of Fascism.
Yes.
How relevant do you feel Reich's psychological critique of fascism is today? And when you look at a Hillary and Bill Clinton, when you look at Donald Trump, when you look at the Bushes, when you look at Ronald Reagan, from my personal opinion, I'm seeing classically defined sociopaths. But that's not what bothers me. What bothers me is not. It is not the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan. It is not the surveillance state, the illegal monitoring of all of our emails, of all of our electronic transmissions. It is not the genetically engineered food or the pesticides like glyphosate. These are all only possible because the average person, even the average academic in America, chooses not to look to see what's right in front of them. That's what scares me. These sociopaths don't scare me because they're too damn obvious. It's easy to see what they're doing. It is the average American that is either dumbing down, is simple-minded and incapable of understanding, an entire new generation that are brain dead, in my opinion, with few exceptions. They're graduating from Harvard and Yale, and if I put them in a debate with a with an alley cat, the alley cat would win.
I think that
I'd like for you to address this.
Reich's mass psychology of fascism is as relevant or more relevant today than it has ever been. Yeah. The key element that he points to is the trained helplessness of the masses of people. And that's what you're describing, Gary, when you say that, you know, it's right in front of people's faces and they still just shrug their shoulders and say, well, there's nothing I can do about it. And if occasionally a figure like an Edward Snowden or Tom Drake stands up to this kind of thing, then the power of the state is used to really crack down on them in a very forceful way that frightens the few people who might start wanting to think about things out of daring to do so and frightens them back into their state of helplessness. But, I mean, the vast majority of people, as Reich would have put it, are constantly looking for a strong father figure to tell them what to do, especially when times are very difficult and there's scary things like, quote-unquote, terrorism going on. Then people want to be told what to do, a product of what Reich called their emotional and biological armoring. And, I mean, in that sense, I would say Reich's work is more screamingly relevant today than it has ever been, in my view.
Yeah, and to that I would add, I agree with everything Professor Strick says. I think it's significant to remember, in the book we're talking about, which Reich published in 1933, shortly after he had fled from Nazi Germany, it was a book that he had been working on for several years while he was living in Berlin, and finally published it when he was forced to leave Berlin. In that book, Reich critiques both Hitler and Stalin. He is critiquing both the communist movement, and he is critiquing the Nazi movement. But it's all sort of under this umbrella of authoritarianism and the fact that fascism, and when Reich talks about fascism, he's really transcending party lines, right, left. He's talking about it as really an overarching phenomenon. And while we can certainly blame those fascist leaders at the time, Hitler, Stalin, no one is absolving them of anything, one of the points that Reich makes is that this is only possible because of the masses of people yearning for an authoritarian figure, whether it's someone on the right or someone on the left at that time, whether it's Hitler, whether it's Stalin, whether it's Nazism or communism or socialism or whatever it is. And so this yearning for an authoritarian figure, and we do, and we have been seeing this word authoritarian being played out, you know, in the last few months on the political scene and everything. And as soon as I start to see that word bandied about, I immediately go back to mass psychology of fascism. But I think the point really to be made is we're transcending party lines here. It's about more than right and left. It's about a basic yearning in the masses of people for an authoritarian figure. Why is that happening, and what are the consequences? So, you know, Reich's book, Mass Psychology of Fascism, and he had about three editions of it, and then just tragically, I'll add this, this was among the 10 book titles that were burned by the Food and Drug Administration in 1956, when Reich's, you know, books were banned and burned. It's just very sadly ironic. Mass Psychology of Fascism, you know, ends up in the flames in America.
Would you address the same question, please, James?
You mean about the book burning, or you mean about fascism?
Fascism.
Well, as I said before, I think, you know, Reich's key insight is that, and this is also what Mr. Hinchey just said, it is that fascism is only possible when you have the masses of people psychologically unable to take responsibility for their lives, and psychologically, especially in times of trouble, in times of stress, economic or otherwise, turning to look for authority figures to take responsibility away from them. That is a profound mass phenomenon that has not gone away. I mean, whatever we think about a quote-unquote sexual revolution in the United States, whatever we think about the change in political climate now compared to the time at the height of the fascist movements in the 1930s and early 40s, the fundamental soil from which fascism grows, in Reich's analysis, the helplessness of the masses psychologically and their willingness to turn over all responsibility to an authority figure, that hasn't gone away. And I think that mass media, you know, the electronic television age, et cetera, keep people distracted and keep their brains tied up in other meaningless kinds of activities in ways that only foster and increase the problem of psychological helplessness. I don't think this problem has gone away at all. And it's only a matter of circumstances when some authoritarian leader comes to the fore and takes advantage of it. But every time you see a major economic crisis, one of my professors in history at Princeton, Arno Mayer, used to say, no revolution without counter-revolution. And whenever you look for a major economic crisis, like in Weimar in the early 1920s, look for far-right movements to begin to surge in power. Whenever you see a migrant crisis make people feel very uncomfortable and uncertain about the future of their jobs, look for the rise of far-right movements and a time when there's danger of political authoritarianism coming to the fore and seizing control, because people surrender control at times like that.
One follow-up to that, Jim. Reich died in prison in November 1957. The reasons for his imprisonment, according to the official narrative, was contempt of court, failing to appear on charges of shipping accumulators across state lines. And yet other events, such as a massive burning of thousands of his books that you just mentioned by the FDA and an orchestrated witch hunt, are part of this narrative. So first, retell the story of censoring, silencing, and eventually imprisoning him, and the death of Reich. And then, if you would, Kevin, would you follow up with that, with the real danger that today we're seeing the CDC censor any of its scientists, including Dr. Thompson, who was showing that they knew a vaccine was dangerous, and the people who found that the vaccines were dangerous and went public with it were people that were then excoriated. So we have very similar situations today as we did then. So would you both address this? And we only have 5 minutes left, so please go right to it.
Why don't you start, Mr. Hinchy?
Yeah, I guess what I would say to that, and we have a limited amount of time, is, you know, it's very interesting. When I started reading Reich's work, and that was about 44 years ago, and so I've been studying this work for a long time, I noticed among a lot of people who were interested in Reich that they would, it almost seemed like Reich's experience in terms of persecutions and everything was singular, was so unique. But as I started doing research over the years, and it's been decades now, I realized while I truly believe that Reich's work itself, all of it, from the psychoanalytic and psychiatric to the biological, medical, meteorological, is singular and very unique, what happened to him is not singular and is not unique. And this is something I also came to a better appreciation of when I first became acquainted with Jim Strick and the conversations that we've occasionally had over the years, because he's a science historian, is what happened to Reich and what happened to some of these other names that you mentioned, Gary, this has been going on for centuries. And so in terms of the persecution of Reich, it fits into a tradition of pioneers being persecuted constantly, and I don't really know what more I can say about it than that. I mean, Reich is very unique in terms of having his books banned and burned in America and dying in prison, but this idea of a pioneering scientist, a pioneering medical person being slandered, being maligned, legal actions taken against him, this is the history of science. This has been going on for centuries. So in that in that regard, Reich is part of a long and very, very tragic tradition.
Thank you, Kevin.
There is this larger phenomenon in the history of science of the tremendous pushback against what's often called paradigm-changing science by, you know, established interests that have a lot of vested interest in the status quo. But in the in Reich's case, you see him also falling into another somewhat more specific tradition, at least in the U.S., where James Turner, a public interest lawyer in Washington, as far back as 1970 in a book called The Chemical Feast, did an expose on many different cases in which the Food and Drug Administration abused federal power in a way that was almost always in concert with the pharmaceutical industry or the, you know, chemical food industry, and often at the expense of public health in cases like saccharin and cyclamates. And he included the Reich case as one, he thought, rather typical case in some ways of the FDA's abuse of power in concert with the pharmaceutical industry. It's worth saying that in Reich's specific case, the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, and the American Psychoanalytical Association all cooperated with the FDA in their case against Reich and thought that Reich was somebody they should be out to destroy as well. I wouldn't want us to run out of time without saying briefly that the documentary film that Mr. Hinchy is working on is currently in a fundraiser on Indiegogo, and that it would really be, for people who are interested in this story and would like to see some kind of factually accurate film finally available about Reich, that film has made quite a lot of progress, but absolutely needs to raise another $70,000, $80,000, $90,000, and this fundraiser goes for 11 more days on Indiegogo. So if you are interested in this story, it would be really helpful if you tried to help make this film possible.
Okay. So we have the information. So please support the film. It is worthy of it. Thank you very much.
Gary, could I just shamelessly shill for 2 seconds?
Yeah, it's got to be real quick. We literally have no more time.
If you want to see a trailer for this film, Google these three words, Reich Documentary Indiegogo, and that'll take you to the campaign and a trailer for the film, Reich Documentary Indiegogo. Thank you, Gary.
All right. Kevin Hinchey. And also Professor James Strick, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. We've been looking at the life and work of one of the great minds of the 20th century, Wilhelm Reich. Thank you for listening. Have a nice day.